revelation prompted religious conservative Tom Barrett to write, "In her Harry Potter books, J.K. Rowling uses material from various pagan religions, including the Druids, witchcraft, Satanism, and dozens of spells and incantations. It should be obvious to anyone who views the books objectively that they are designed to make the evil religion of witchcraft acceptable to young, impressionable children. My daughter will never read one or see any of the movies because I love her." Suppression. Barrett's profound horror about a popular children's tale is part of a long and important part of the story of magic. It's the reason why magic became an esoteric, hidden tradition instead of an exoteric, open practice. The chilling effect of centuries of religious and scientific polemics against magic cannot be overstated. If I were to seriously suggest that the Harry Potter movies are based on a true story, most people would nervously smile and back away. Those with strong religious faith would turn and run. Their stereotyped idea of a witch would cause them to hyperventilate at the thought of hanging out with a coven of friendly witches at the local coffee shop, even if that meeting included a round of delicious chocolate danishes. The marginalization of magic has been so thorough that until the late 20th century, scholars of religion scrupulously avoided talking about esoteric topics, as though they didn't even exist. Anthropologists, too, regarded magic as so obviously idiotic that it was erased from the curriculum. Given such prejudices, it's not surprising that academic interest in esoteric studies has evolved at a snail's pace. Walter J. Hanegraaff, professor of the history of Hermetic philosophy at the University of Amsterdam, is part of a growing group of academics who have specialized in the Western esoteric traditions. Hanegraaff highlighted the academic avoidance of esotericism. During the 19th and much of the 20th century, scholars and intellectuals prided themselves on not knowing anything about such matters, so that deliberate ignorance about the traditions in question became deeply ingrained in academic life. Disenchantment. What sparked this scrupulously willful ignorance? In 1917, German sociologist and philosopher Max Weber, 1864 to 1920, defined a key feature of modern Western society, its disenchantment. Weber was referring to a growing conviction among scientists and scholars of the early 20th century that supernatural concepts were outdated. There was no longer any need for mysterious, incalculable forces, magic, or spirits. There was also no need for institutions that relied on such ideas. Hint, religion. Memories of 1,000 years of intellectual dominance by religious authorities were painfully fresh, so the rise of the disenchanted world became a welcome gust of freedom. This cultural sea change inspired scholars to openly and vigorously reject magic, but not just because it was heretical. That was the church's justification. Now it could be scorned for another reason. Magic was a throwback to pre-scientific concepts. It didn't take long for the mere idea of magic to be regarded as a dastardly affront to science itself. Anthropologists were on the front lines in having to deal with the newly disenchanted world, because in their study of primitive man, they encountered all sorts of curious magical beliefs and practices. Understanding those beliefs and the roles they played in indigenous societies became a major focus of their work. Anthropologists were eager to distinguish themselves from the uneducated, meaning scientifically illiterate, masses. So magic soon became associated with the beliefs of savages, or the lower races. It was certainly not the sort of thing that learned men and women should accept. The first professor of anthropology at Oxford University was Sir Edward Burnett Tylor, 1832 to 1917. Tylor supported the new, scientifically proper way to think about magic, and he wasn't shy about expressing his opinion. He called magic a monstrous farrago, one of the most pernicious delusions that ever vexed mankind. For Tyler, magic was solely a matter of theatrics, superstitions, illusions, and preposterous fantasies. Belief in magic was due to the psychological need to cope with the uncertainties of life by gaining an illusory control over non-existent supernatural forces. Tyler's influence over future generations of anthropologists was immense. His insistence that magic was nonsense quickly gathered support among his contemporaries, and it set in stone what nearly all anthropologists believed, or at least what they were comfortable talking about in public, for more than a century. Following Tyler's lead, Sir James G. Frazer's 1854-1941 influential book, The Golden Bough, published in 1922, continued the magic bashing. In referring to sympathetic magic, Frazer wrote, "A mistaken association of similar ideas produces homeopathic or imitative magic. A mistaken association of contiguous ideas produces contagious magic. The principles of association are excellent in themselves, and indeed absolutely essential to the working of the human mind. Legitimately applied, they yield science. Illegitimately applied, they yield magic, the bastard sister of science. It is therefore a truism, almost a tautology, to say that all magic is necessarily false and barren." The notion that magic was an obviously false practice was widely and uncritically accepted among anthropologists. In 1901, Columbia University granted its first Ph.D. in anthropology to Alfred L. Kroeber, 1876-1960, who, incidentally, was the father of the well-known fantasy and science fiction author Ursula K. Le Guin. In Kroeber's textbook on anthropology, published a year after Frazer's, we find the following, directly out of Tyler's playbook. "Beliefs in magic, such as are normal in backward societies, do recur in cultures that by profession have discarded magic, but chiefly among individuals whose social fortune is backward, or who are psychotic, mentally deteriorated, or otherwise subnormal." Half a century later, Hans-Dieter Betz, of the Department of New Testament and Early Christian Literature at the University of Chicago Divinity School, edited a large volume on the Greek magical papyri. This is a collection of translated magical spells and formulas, hymns, and rituals from ancient Greco-Roman Egyptian scrolls. The volume was advertised as an invaluable resource for scholars in a wide variety of fields, from the history of religions to the classical languages and literatures, and it will fascinate those with a general interest in the occult and the history of magic. Fascinate, yes, but Betz felt it necessary to add Tyler's damning opinion in his opening remarks to make sure the reader understood that despite spending enormous amounts of time and energy writing a gigantic book on magical spells, of course he didn't believe in any of it. Betz's insistence reflected the schizophrenic split that scholars sometimes feel when confronted with magic. They are drawn to it like moths to a flame, but they are also obligated to deny the dangerous attraction. Historian Owen Davies of the University of Hertfordshire describes the academic denial of magic as pronouncements puffed up with the sense of Western superiority. As an example of that puffery, we find Betz professing, "Magic is the art that makes people who practice it feel better rather than worse, that provides the illusion of security to the insecure, the feeling of help to the helpless, and the comfort of hope to the hopeless. Of course, it is all deception. But who can endure naked reality, especially when there is a way to avoid it? This is why magic has worked and continues to work, no matter what the evidence may be." Not all anthropologists agreed with Tyler. In 1982, Michael Winkelmann published an article in Current Anthropology a stolid academic journal published by the University of Chicago Press, on the relevance of psi research to the study of magical beliefs among primitive peoples. Winkelmann's article was followed by nearly 20 commentaries by other anthropologists. This is a common procedure in journals. It's a convenient way to disseminate scholarly debates on controversial topics. Winkelmann began his review by stating the obvious, that most anthropologists had adopted the scientific worldview that magic didn't exist. Most anthropological theories about magic were, and still are, based on psychological or sociological reasons why indigenous peoples can so easily sustain their delusions. To make his case that this common assumption may be mistaken, Winkelmann reviewed articles in the anthropological literature from the late 1800s through the 1940s. He showed, based on first-hand anecdotal reports from military officers, physicians, clergymen, and colonial officers, that anthropologists had long noted that some aspects of magic practiced by indigenous peoples appeared to be real. In addition, those magical practices seemed to be consistent with conditions found to enhance psi effects in laboratory studies, including a reliance on altered states of consciousness, concentrated visualization, goal-oriented imagery, positive expectations, strong belief, and intense emotions. Winkelmann proposed that the tendency to equate magical beliefs, which are testable, with religious beliefs, which are not, had led anthropologists astray. They regarded magic as a magico-religious faith. If instead they had thought of magic as a magico-scientific practice, then the idea that magic must be due only to trickery or self-deception could have been put to the test rather than simply assumed. Most of the commentaries following Winkelmann's article were in the spirit of polite academic debate, some supportive of the article and others more critical. But one commentary was not like the others. It dragged on for 7 pages. It was so long that the editor of the journal apologized for its inclusion, noting that it was an extreme departure from their usual policy. The author of the lengthy screed was furious that a dignified academic journal would even consider publishing an article like Winkelmann's. What caused that outburst? Tyler's ghost. Some 30 years after Winkelmann's article, psychologist David Luke from the University of Greenwich asked if anthropology and parapsychology were still hostile sisters in science. Luke pointed out that cracks in the resistance had been building since the 1950s. In 1952, an anthropologist elder and past president of the American Anthropological Association, AAA, Dr. John Swanton, wrote an open letter urging anthropologists to take seriously the implications of psi phenomena in the study of magic. 7 years later, the topic was discussed at the AAA annual meeting. The symposium was standing room only and charged with high emotion. Famed anthropologist Margaret Mead, 1901 to 1978, was present, and it took her support for the psi magic thesis to shatter the impasse. Around the same time, in his classic text on shamanism, influential University of Chicago philosopher and historian of religion, Mircea Eliade, 1907 to 1986, wrote that a fairly large number of ethnographic documents has already put the authenticity of such paranormal phenomena beyond doubt. The formation of the Society for the Anthropology of Consciousness in 1974 was a turning point, especially when that society was formally absorbed into the AAA in 1990. Anthropologist William S. Lyon, who has studied Native American shamanic beliefs and practices, is representative of modern scholars who are increasingly dissatisfied with making believe that magic doesn't exist. He writes, "We know academia currently treats magic as the result of primitive superstition or magical thinking. So how did it come to pass that despite throughout all of human history, a belief in magic appears in every recorded culture on the planet, in the last 150 years, scientists have come to treat it as not real? The simple answer is magic did not fit our mechanistic view of reality, so it needed to be abandoned. Witch hunts. While some scholars still argue that magic is all based on deception, their pronouncements haven't stopped the tragedy of witch hunts, which are still luridly alive in some areas of the world. In 2014, more than 1,000 women in Tanzania, all believed to be witches by frightened neighbors, were lynched, stoned, or hacked to death. And according to a 2014 article in the New York Times, the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights reported that most of the 25,000 to 50,000 children who live on the streets of Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo, were abandoned by family members who accused them of witchcraft or demonic possession. The same article mentions how the Catholic Church, which is not known for its historical tolerance of witches, is providing shelter for accused witches in Papua New Guinea. Besides the fear of being declared a witch in some parts of the world, concerns about being surreptitiously watched by someone or something at a distance are becoming more common with the flourishing of electronic and drone surveillance. Such concerns are not unreasonable, but paranoia that someone is constantly watching, or worse, influencing your thoughts, is a classic symptom of schizophrenia. Before you visit a magician or an exorcist, please visit a psychiatrist first to see if there might be an organic reason for you to have such fears. Sometimes these obsessions arise due to misfirings in the brain or to biochemical imbalances. If so, the obsession can be treated. I mention this because the line between real and illusory can become uncomfortably thin the moment one opens the door to the possibility of genuine magic. In particular, anyone who is casually pursuing magic as a practice should be cautious. If you take that path, it's especially important to maintain strong social connections so you can talk about your experiences and remain psychologically well-grounded. Magic is a fascinating topic because it raises many interesting questions about the nature of consciousness and its role in reality. But using magic in an attempt to manipulate reality or conjure spirits can be psychologically destabilizing. Even the innocent use of the ever-popular Ouija board game can, for a small percentage of people, lead to major psychological problems. Dropping down the rabbit hole into the unknown is exciting, but it's not without risk. Magical thinking. While many scientists are quick to dismiss magical thinking as nonsense, the fact is that practically everyone engages in magical thinking all the time. To account for this, psychologists have proposed four main explanations. One, believers are wretchedly ignorant or sadly embedded within a religious culture that regards magic to be self-evident. Two, believers are burdened with one or more cognitive or reasoning defects. Three, believers are mentally ill or are high on a scale of schizotypy, that is, they have a tendency towards schizophrenic ideation. Or, four, everyone's brains are just hardwired to believe in magic. In other words, if you believe in magic, either you're stupid, you're nuts, or you can't help it. That last explanation covers everyone, presumably including those who proposed these explanations. Without being cavalier about it, it's fair to say that some aspects of magical thinking can indeed be due to psychiatric problems or cognitive frailties. But it's also recognized that even smart, educated, emotionally stable adults have superstitions that are not rational. Fortunately, a growing consensus among psychologists suggests that magical thinking may not be so bad after all. it can help us cope with difficult times and decisions. And positive thinking, even if superstitious, can be good for your mental and physical health. In 2010, in Scientific American, psychologist Piercarlo Valdesolo agreed with the new appreciation for magical thinking in an article entitled "Why Magical Thinking Works for Some People." Valdesolo writes, "Can belief in magical charms actually have an influence over one's ability to, say, perform better on a test or in an athletic competition? The mere suggestion that a golf ball was lucky significantly influenced performance, causing participants to make almost 2 more putts on average. Why? Surely it couldn't be that the same golf ball becomes lucky at the experimenter's suggestion. There must be an explanation grounded in the psychological influence that belief in lucky charms has on the superstitious. Must the explanation only be psychological? Are there no other possibilities? Let's find out." Chapter 4. Origins of Magic. I think back in the caveman days, our ancestors would huddle around the fire at night, and wolves would be howling in the dark just beyond the light. And one person would start talking, and he would tell a story so we wouldn't be so scared in the dark. John Logan, from the 2016 movie Genius. Magic is to religion as technology is to science. That is, one difference between religion and magic is that the former is essentially a faith-based theory about the nature of reality, while the latter involves testable applications of that theory. Theories provide meaningful structures proposed to account for an otherwise chaotic and bewildering existence, while applications provide the means of controlling some of the chaos. The religion-magic relationship is actually more complex than the science-technology connection because there are two major categories of magic, supernatural and natural. Initially, everything was considered to be supernatural because our earliest ancestors had no idea about how anything worked. So they naturally attributed everything to invisible supernatural causes, meaning above or beyond the natural world, the divine, or one or more gods. Then someone noticed that there were aspects of nature that were predictable, the movements of the sun and stars, healing qualities of certain muds and plants. And that realization sparked interest in visible, here and now, human-centric natural magic. Supernatural magic was eventually adopted by religion, and natural magic split into two branches, the exoteric, outer physical world, and the esoteric, inner mental world. The exoteric branch evolved into today's science. The esoteric branch is where magic has been hiding. Natural magic evolved into science as refined methods and technologies were developed that allowed us to control natural forces, like electricity, and to perceive beyond the common senses, as with a microscope. If instruments like the electric battery and the telescope had never been invented, life today in many ways would be as it was in the late Middle Ages. But with such instruments and many others like them, our worldview significantly expanded. Theories were developed to account for the new observations, and in the process we've become highly adept at focusing on the outer physical world. We know that our worldview is accurate because it continues to spawn reliable technologies, many of which would have seemed like pure magic even as recently as the 1950s. Indeed, in the early 21st century, it's probably fair to say that most people have no idea how computing or communication technologies work. I don't mean work in the sense of knowing how to operate a computer or a smartphone, but rather in the sense of knowing how to build these devices from scratch, or even understanding the main principles underlying these devices. These technologies aren't considered magic because their easy availability gives us faith that someone, somewhere, or more likely teams of specialists distributed around the globe, knows how they work. Meanwhile, esoteric magic has also evolved, using its own methods and theories. Not surprisingly, the esoteric worldview is very different from the one that's the basis of today's technologies. A comprehensive review of the history of esotericism is beyond the scope of any single chapter. This topic is deeply entwined with the histories of science, religion, philosophy, and metaphysics, and it's been explored in fastidious detail by many generations of scholars. But it's important to review it here, even if briefly, to give you a feeling for two central ideas. First, that esoteric ideas have been vigorously suppressed in the Western world for at least 1,000 years. And second, that the esoteric worldview provides hints for why magic works. Prehistoric times. Given the mystery of life, its endless uncertainties, and the certainty of death, the first self-aware creatures were strongly motivated to understand how they had ended up in this mess and whether there might be something better to look forward to. Some of those early souls may have gained mystical glimpses of reality through the discovery and use of entheogenic, psychedelic, compounds. A persuasive case for this possibility is made by the esteemed religious scholar Houston Smith in his book Cleansing the Doors of Perception. As language developed, the experiences of these early psychonauts, amplified by their creative imaginations, became codified into cosmologies, that is, origin stories. Individuals who were especially adept at entering these rarefied states of awareness, which afforded visions of reality beyond the here and now, were the first magicians and shamans. Religions developed as the mystical cosmologies were elaborated. Later, those origin stories were supplemented with rules for acceptable behavior and proper forms of homage to authority. Shamans didn't enter these states because all the cool kids were doing it. Rather, they did it because their tribe's survival depended on it. They were healers, oracles, and warriors wrapped into one, and they were charged with sustaining their tribe and defending it against rival groups through whatever means necessary, including magical techniques. Ancient times. As tribes' settlements matured into towns, cities, and empires, the cognoscenti of the day gained the luxury of time to turn their thoughts from matters of daily subsistence to grander concepts of spirituality and religion. German-Swiss philosopher Karl Jaspers, 1883 to 1969, labeled the period from about 800 to 200 BCE the Axial Age. The term refers to an intellectual swing from matters of basic survival to more abstract and transcendent ideas. Given today's fast pace, you might have to schlep through a computer or smartphone software update every month or two. But in primordial times, thousands of years and untold hundreds of human generations would come and go, and absolutely nothing would change. Considering the almost inconceivably leisurely pace of our ancestors' lives, the 600-year axial age arrived like a historical lightning bolt. During that period, Taoism and Confucianism emerged in China. Buddhism, Hinduism, and Jainism appeared in India. The Hebrew prophets Isaiah, Jeremiah, and others emerged in Palestine. Zoroaster, the Greek name of the Persian prophet Zarathustra, founded one of the first monotheistic religions, and the Greek philosophers, including Pythagoras, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, did something new. They questioned the origins of the universe, pondered the meaning, morality, and fate of humanity, and founded the origins of logic, mathematics, and rational analysis. This shift in perspective is sometimes referred to as the emergence of second-order thought, in that humans, at least the ruling classes, began to think about themselves from broader or higher perspectives. The new way of thinking led humanity away from worship of tribal deities and toward contemplation of more universal concepts. Unified kingdoms and supreme gods became a new vision. To achieve such goals, it was necessary to develop ways other than raw brutality to respond to insults and other aggressions. The new vision was hopeful, an aspiration that has always been difficult to sustain given our hard-wired drive to strike first and ask questions later. But the impulse was set, and a case can be made that human violence has steadily declined as civilization has spread throughout the world. Of course, instances of violence tend to saturate the news media, so it might seem like the world is becoming more dangerous, but that's only because breaking news reports of carnage cause our hearts to beat faster than calm stories about simple human kindness. One of the sparks that energized the Axial Age may have emerged from personal experiences within the various mystery schools, which flourished throughout the ancient world. These schools had similar goals. Initiation into the mysteries sought to open the immortal eyes of man inwards, exalt his powers of perception until they could receive the messages of a higher degree of reality. In practice, this consisted of experiencing a ritual death of the physical body and subsequent resurrection into a new body with new capabilities of intuiting secret wisdom, often regarding the functioning of the body itself. One of the longest-lasting schools was the Greek Eleusinian Mysteries, active from about 1500 BCE to 392 CE. Most of the Greek philosophers regarded the mysteries with awe. Even the Roman skeptic Cicero, 106 to 43 BCE, wrote, "Nothing is higher than these mysteries. They have not only shown us how to live joyfully, but they have taught us how to die with a better hope." Hundreds of years later, the Greek philosopher and statesman Themistios, 317 to 385 CE, mentioned the Eleusinian Mysteries in an essay he wrote on the soul. "The soul, at death, has the same experience as those who are being initiated into great mysteries. At first one wanders and wearily hurries to and fro, and journeys with suspicion through the dark as one uninitiated. Then come all the terrors before the final initiation, shuddering, trembling, sweating, amazement. Then one is struck with a marvelous light. One is received into pure regions and meadows, with voices and dances and the majesty of holy sounds and shapes. Among these, he who has fulfilled initiation wanders free and released, and, bearing his crown, joins in the divine communion and consorts with pure and holy men." The lesser rites of the Eleusinian Mysteries involved a theatrical allegory of what supposedly happened after death. It was unusually democratic for its time, being available to both citizens and slaves. But the greater rites were available only to selected patrons. These were said to provide a personal experience of the afterlife. The ritual included drinking a potion known as kaikion, a mixture consisting of barley, mint, and water. Kaikion might have been similar to soma, the potion mentioned in the Hindu Vedas that some scholars now believe was an entheogenic compound. While the actual composition of these concoctions is unknown, we do know that they were made from grains, and ergot, a poisonous fungus that commonly grows on grains, contains lysergic acid, the core component of the most powerful psychedelic drug, lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. The Eleusinian Mystery School was forced to close in 392 CE when Christian Emperor Theodosius I, head of the Holy Roman Empire, officially declared the rites pagan and therefore heretical. That is, they were so popular that they interfered with the church's authority. One of the more famous mystery school initiates was Plato, 427 to 347 BCE, student of Socrates and teacher of Aristotle. Plato proposed the existence of a higher domain of pure ideas. To help explain his concept, Plato used an allegory of prisoners in a cave. As the story goes, these prisoners spent their entire lives chained up in a cave in such a way that all they could see was the cave wall in front of them. They couldn't see a fire that was glowing behind them, nor that a group of actors was holding up puppets and casting shadows on the wall of the cave. For these prisoners, their entire world consisted of those shadows. One day, a prisoner was released from the cave and taken outside. At first blinded by the light, after a while his eyes adjusted to the brilliance, and for the first time he saw the vibrant colors and depth of real reality. His former ideas about the world were shattered, and when he was allowed to return to the cave, he excitedly explained to the other prisoners that their shadow existence was an illusion. There was a richer, intensely luminous world just a few steps outside the cave. But regardless of what he said or the arguments he used to try to convince them that their reality was a pale cartoon of reality, the other prisoners thought he had gone mad. Plato used this allegory to argue that there was a difference between the everyday appearance of the world, shaped by everyday language and concepts, and the world itself. Common sense provides a poor facsimile of what is really out there, so to grasp the true nature of reality, Plato imagined that this consisted of what he called eternal forms or ideas, requires a special form of knowing called gnosis. Knowledge gained through gnosis is different from intellectual or rational knowing. American psychologist and philosopher William James, 1842 to 1910, provided a definition for a similar word, noetic, in his famous book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, 1902. Noetic experiences were, as he described in the flowery language of the early 20th century, states of insight into depths of truth unplumbed by the discursive intellect. They are illuminations, revelations, full of significance and importance, all inarticulate though they remain, and as a rule they carry with them a curious sense of authority. Gnosis is thus a type of deep intuition, a means of knowing that transcends the ordinary senses and rational thought, like knowing from the heart. A mother knows she loves her child. It's not something she has to rationally, logically, or analytically figure out. Note that gnosis, being non-rational, does not mean it's irrational, for that would imply faulty knowledge. From the perspective of magical practice, gnosis may be thought of as an intense consciousness of something. The term grok, from Robert Heinlein's 1961 science fiction novel Stranger in a Strange Land, also gets at this idea. At one point in that novel, the character Mahmud describes grok as, "To understand so thoroughly that the observer becomes a part of the observed, to merge, blend, intermarry, lose identity in group experience. It means almost everything that we mean by religion, philosophy, and science. And it means as little to us ordinary humans as color does to a blind man." During the Hellenistic period in Greece, from the death of Alexander the Great in 323 BCE to the emergence of the Roman Empire in 31 BCE, Plato's ideas evolved into an esoteric worldview. A key figure associated with development of what is now called Neoplatonism was Plotinus, 204 to 270 CE, a philosopher born in Egypt half a millennium after Plato. Neoplatonism proposed the existence of deep interconnections among all things, including what is normally viewed as the distinction between mental and physical phenomena. From the everyday ego-based state of awareness, I'll call this personal form of consciousness lowercase c, mind and matter appear to be fundamentally different. But from the rarefied state of gnosis, which provides direct access to higher states of existence, I'll call this state of universal consciousness, capital C, the apparent distinctions between mind and matter, or space and time, are revealed as illusions. That is, from lowercase c, we see objects separated in space and time, and we see obvious differences between mental and physical phenomena. But from capital C, all such differences dissolve, and naked reality is experienced as entangled relationships in a holistic reality, completely free of the constraints of space or time. From capital C, you directly perceive what lowercase c experiences as the future or the past. From capital C, you also transcend the distinctions that separate you from other objects. And by so doing, you can directly influence the physical world. That is, in a domain without separation, you may become one with, say, a dark cloud, whereupon you could introduce an intention to rain. Or by becoming one with a friend, you could know your friend's thoughts and emotions. By proposing the notion of a higher reality beyond the shadow existence of ordinary experience, Plato and later Neoplatonism provided a worldview that opened the door to the possibility of real magic. Treatises on Neoplatonism and many other esoteric ideas were collected in one of the supreme accomplishments of ancient times, the Library of Alexander of Macedonia, 356 BCE to 323 BCE, better known as Alexander the Great. Alexander charged this library with collecting all of the world's knowledge. He began it in 334 BCE, and in its prime, the Alexandrian Library was the largest single repository of knowledge in the world, the Internet of the ancient world. The library contained over 500,000 documents collected from Assyria, Greece, Persia, Egypt, India, and many other places. More than 100 scholars from all civilized countries traveled to the library to live, study, and translate the documents into all known languages. After being the hub of the world's knowledge for 200 years, the library was partially destroyed by an accident in 48 BCE when Julius Caesar ordered ships in the harbor to be burned during a military campaign. The fire spread to the docks and eventually destroyed part of the library. Over the next 500 years, the library was slowly whittled away as the city came under the control of different factions and religious authorities. Stories have been told about how one or another individual was responsible for burning or gutting the library, but scholars today agree that most of those stories were apocryphal. There are undoubtedly many reasons the library slowly dissolved, but the full story is lost in the mists of time. Fortunately, over the centuries of its existence, many of its documents were copied by scholars from other countries, so portions of the ancient world's knowledge were retained. Much of that knowledge was about magic. This is not to say that real magic was uniformly accepted by ancient scholars. Some regarded claims about magic with disdain. An example is the Greek historian Pliny the Elder, 23 to 79 CE, author of one of the earliest known encyclopedias. Entitled Naturalis Historia, Natural History, Pliny's work was consulted by scholars for 1,000 years. Regarding magic, he wrote, "Without doubt, magic arose in Persia with Zoroaster. On this, our authorities are agreed, but whether he was the only one of that name, or whether there was also another afterwards, is not clear." He also wrote, "I have often indeed refuted the fraudulent lies of the Magi, whenever the subject and the occasion required it, and I shall continue to expose them. In a few respects, however, the theme deserves to be enlarged upon, were it only because the most fraudulent of arts has held complete sway throughout the world for many ages. And yet after that opening dismissive salvo, Pliny goes on to describe more than 60 recipes that the magi of the day used to treat various ailments. Some of those methods were based on sympathetic magic, the idea that objects with certain appearances or properties would sympathize or resonate with similar objects. Thus, to reduce a fever, the magi might create an amulet that looked like a snake, or contained bits of a snake, because a snake bite can produce the sensation of a fever. But not all folk medicine was based on magical concepts. Many treatments were developed by pure trial and error. Here's Pliny's description of how to treat a cold and sore throat. I find that a heavy cold clears up if the sufferer kisses a mule's muzzle. Pain in the uvula and in the throat is relieved by the dung, dried in shade, of lambs that have not yet eaten grass. Uvula pain by applying the juice of a snail transfixed by a needle, so that the snail itself may be hung up in the smoke, and by the ash of swallows with honey. Kissing a mule on the snout and gargling with dried, grassless lamb dung sounds a lot worse than suffering through a cold and sore throat. Maybe patients just said that the treatment was soothing, so they didn't have to do that again. But there's also an alternative explanation. Some of these ingredients, as odd as they sound, may have had chemical properties that were medically useful. For example, an article in the European Journal of Pharmaceutical and Medical Research describes how cow urine, a traditional Ayurveda elixir, has antioxidant, anti-diabetic, wound-healing, and immunomodulatory properties. We are so used to synthetic drugs today that it's easy to forget that modern pharmaceuticals are a recent invention. For millennia, the pharmacopoeia consisted exclusively of natural ingredients, because that's all that was available. Sometimes those forms of natural magic worked wonders, and for reasons that we're only now beginning to understand in modern terms. Early Middle Ages. Also known as the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages refers to a period of about 1,000 years in Europe from the fall of the Roman Empire to the beginning of the Renaissance, roughly from the 5th to 14th centuries. After Rome fell to the barbarians, other than a few pockets of civilization, most of Europe turned into one of those post-apocalyptic zombie movies. All forms of scholarship in Europe significantly subsided. To further tarnish the image of the early Middle Ages as a desirable travel destination for future time travelers, during that period the Catholic Church's tolerance of magic rapidly dissipated as church leaders clamped down on the widespread popularity of pagan beliefs. In the early 13th century, Pope Gregory IX created the holy police force known as the Inquisition to combat heresy. In 1252, Pope Innocent IV formalized the Inquisition and authorized it to use torture to force confessions and to burn people alive for their heretical beliefs. About 200 years later, Pope Innocent VIII authorized two inquisitors, Jakob Sprenger and Heinrich Kramer, to accelerate the holy work of the Inquisition. Sprenger and Kramer wrote a book entitled Malleus Maleficarum, The Witch's Hammer, which essentially turned witch hunting into a religiously sanctioned sport. Hundreds of thousands of people, perhaps as many as 1 million, were arrested, tortured, and killed at the hands of the Inquisition. These horrific acts forced esoteric interests deep underground, and the cultural memory of the terror associated with being declared deviant because of one's ideas or beliefs continues to affect us today. Now, for reasons you'll presently discover, we'll briefly jump 500 years into the future, to 1945 in Nag Hammadi, a city on the Nile in Upper Egypt. At that time, a set of 13 ancient papyrus manuscripts was discovered. These texts, which were not fully translated until the 1970s, altered our understanding of the Christian Bible. Known as the Nag Hammadi Codices, they describe Gnostic Gospels that were left out of early efforts to establish the Orthodox interpretation of Christianity, perhaps because the information provided by these Gospels differed from the stories included in the New Testament. The Gnostic Gospels include the Gospel of Thomas, which begins with a startling opening sentence. "These are the secret words which the living Jesus spoke, and which the twin Judas Thomas wrote down." Elaine Pagel's book, The Gnostic Gospels, provides an excellent description of the discovery and mysteries of the Nag Hammadi manuscripts and their influence on understanding the origins of Christianity as we know it today. Returning to the early Middle Ages, the esoteric tradition of Gnosticism, like Neoplatonism, viewed the central importance of Gnosis as a way of directly perceiving higher states of being. But it also added a distinct sense of purpose to Neoplatonism's cosmology. The Gnostics taught that we are like the prisoners chained up in Plato's cave. That is, we have a spark of the divine within us, but we're unaware of it. Fortunately, even though we fell from grace, we can work our way back up the spiritual hierarchy by attaining gnosis of our true being. In this way, the Gnostic allegory provided a way to escape from the chains of ignorance and the suffering of the material world. We can be like Plato's prisoner who escaped from the cave. The Gnostics regarded the Catholic Church with disdain, seeing it as having lost its way through corruption and politics, and having neglected the teachings of Christ. As one might imagine, church authorities were not amused by this criticism, as dramatically exemplified by the plight of the Cathars. The Cathars were a group of Gnostic Christians in the town of Béziers in southern France. The 13th century Pope Innocent III was increasingly annoyed by the Gnostics because their criticism was becoming a major challenge to his authority. The Cathars even went so far as to accuse the Pope of being the puppet of Satan. So the Pope sent his army of crusaders to Béziers, accompanied by his representative, a French monk named Arnaud Amalric. The military leader of the crusaders was Simon de Montfort, a French nobleman who was offered a cruel incentive by the Pope. De Montfort could keep the land of any Cathar heretic that he dispatched. On July 22, 1209, De Montfort arrived at Béziers and demanded that the town turn over the Cathar heretics. The town refused, and the crusaders attacked. During the siege, a soldier asked Amalric how they were supposed to tell who was a heretic and who was a proper Catholic. Amalric famously replied, "Kill them all. Let God sort them out." All 20,000 people in the town were massacred, and the city was burned to the ground. On July 22, 2009, the town of Béziers observed the 800th anniversary of this massacre. History lesson. It is advisable to think twice about annoying those in power. The Renaissance. During the Renaissance, from the 14th through the 17th century, translations of manuscripts long held in Arabic, Greek, and Asian states were slowly being reintroduced to Western scholars. The invention of the printing press in the 14th century and distribution of the translated texts resulted in an explosion of renewed ideas and relief from the stagnation of the previous 1,000 years. This in turn stimulated an upheaval in religion, politics, economics, and scholarship, and it established the basic structures and Western cultural beliefs that would come to define the modern world. Religious reformers such as Martin Luther challenged the rigid authority of the Catholic Church, its increasingly corrupt practices, and its monopoly in defining what Christian practice meant. That challenge provoked decades of wars and persecutions, but it also dramatically changed European politics and national boundaries. As old structures began to crumble, the dust generated a heavy price in the form of nearly continuous conflicts. Fortunately, it also fostered a new intellectual openness that eventually allowed for the rediscovery of Hermeticism. Hermeticism is named after Hermes, the son of the Greek gods Zeus and Maia. Hermes is known as Mercury in the Roman pantheon and Thoth in the Egyptian pantheon. Hermes/Mercury/Thoth was considered an emissary between the gods and humans, the god of writing, wisdom, and magic, and a trickster. Thoth was held in such high regard by the Egyptians that referring to him as Thoth the Great was simply not good enough. Even double great Thoth wasn't adequate. But, like in the Goldilocks tale, great-great-great Thoth was just about right. That honorific title led to Thoth's better-known Greek name, Hermes Trismegistus, Hermes three times great. Hermetic cosmology contends that reality consists of a single universal consciousness known by many names, the one mind, the divine, the Tao, Brahman, Allah, God, Source, and so on. To avoid religious connotations of these terms, I've referred to this concept of consciousness with a capital C. In Hermeticism, capital C appears in two complementary aspects, like the two sides of the same coin. One form is a manifested primordial plastic energy, sometimes referred to within the alchemical tradition as the one thing. The other form is a non-manifested transcendent element known as the one mind. The one thing reacts to and is shaped by the one mind. The one thing is similar to the Hindu idea of Akasha. In Swami Vivekananda's book, Raja Yoga, Akasha is described as follows. It is the omnipresent, all-penetrating existence. Everything that has form, everything that is the result of combination, it is evolved out of this Akasha. It is the Akasha that becomes the air, that becomes the liquids, that becomes the solids. It cannot be perceived. It is so subtle that it is beyond all ordinary perception. At the beginning of creation, there is only this Akasha. Because the one thing is viewed as a consciousness-shaping substance, its appearance depends on who's looking and what they're expecting to see. Moses was stunned to encounter a burning bush that spoke to him. On October 13, 1917, three children near Fatima, Portugal, saw the Virgin Mary, while tens of thousands of others who were present witnessed anomalous lights and atmospheric effects that seem very much like what we today describe as a UFO. Hermeticism may sound like a dualistic concept, with the one mind and the one thing being starkly different from each other, but that's only because capital C is beyond human comprehension, so it's just described in two forms that are easier to grok. That is, the one mind only has the appearance of being different from the one thing. Similarly, personal consciousness, lowercase c, is not separate from the physical world. In other words, from the Hermetic perspective, reality is not just physical, it's psychophysical. This interaction is commonly studied in the form of mind-body connections within the mainstream scientific disciplines of psychoneuroimmunology, psychophysiology, and the neurosciences. It's also the basis of psychosomatic medicine and the placebo effect. But when lowercase c influences the physical world outside of the body, which it can do because lowercase c has properties similar to capital C, then that's called magic. Hermeticism was considered heretical by the Church because it asserts that all humans have an inherent spark of divine power within us. That is, we have godlike abilities because lowercase c is a part of capital C. As a result, from the Hermeticist's perspective, there were no special benefits conferred by following someone else's dogma because each of us could achieve enlightenment on our own. As you may imagine, such insolence was unacceptable, so the Church applied its well-honed strategy for maintaining control.